Welcome to an episode of What Matters in North Carolina. As always, I'm your host, Matt Calder, and we are glad you're here with us. Whether you're listening on the radio terrestrially, you're listening on the website at freedomactionnetwork.com, or you've already subscribed to the show and are listening on your device. If you haven't subscribed to the show, you can do that by going and searching What Matters in North Carolina on your device where you would listen to podcasts. So it's Apple Podcasts if you're an Apple user, or whatever podcasting app you use if you're an Android user like me. And then you can get the show to your device there. Also, go to our Facebook and Twitter and search What Matters NC. You'll be able to follow along with us on Facebook, and you can like our page there and follow us on Twitter and see what we've got going on outside of this. You can also call us at 919-747-8063. Again, that's 919-747-8063. Leave us a clean, concise message, a minute or two, about something you want to talk about, a comment you have on a segment we did, or something you'd like us to talk about in the future. If it's good, we'll play it on the air. Today, we are going to be talking with Brooke Medina of the Civitas Institute about her most recent article in the Toxic Agenda series that the Civitas Institute has going. And of course, the Civitas Institute sponsors this show, and you can find out more about them at nccivitas.org. The Civitas Institute is North Carolina's conservative voice, but we'll be talking with her about her abortion policy article as part of that Toxic Agenda series we started talking with Brian Balfour about last show. And then we'll talk with Ray Notestein, also of the Civitas Institute, about the meaning behind Christmas and what the meaning of Christmas is. A lot of times that's lost in the season, and we're going to catch up with Ray and talk about what that really is. So without any further ado, we'll jump in right into that segment with Brooke Medina. Brooke, thanks for coming back on the show.
Glad to be here, Matt.
So we are going to, I guess this is kind of a part two segment, or part two of a highlighting the Civitas Institute's Toxic Agenda series that's going on. And as we talked last time with Brian Balfour about his article on Medicaid reform, we of course said the Toxic Agenda series is highlighting a range of different topics that are kind of wish list items of the left, is the kind of the way I tried to explain it. And I said, you know, these are all sorts of different topics, and your topic today definitely shows the difference, because, you know, we're going from Medicaid to abortion as the topic. And I guess kind of open us up and tell us a little about your most recent piece on the Civitas website.
Great. Yes. So like you said, the Toxic Agenda is the basically an exposure of the left's agenda here in the state. Should they be back in power and have the ability to craft legislation to their liking? And from the Medicaid expansion aspect, which, you know, really redistributes things in a way that is supposedly equitable and egalitarian, but truly isn't, because of the long-term consequences of handling our citizens' finances that way, to the way in which we treat and approach women's rights. And that's what I wanted to focus on in this article, was how under this guise of women's rights, we have certain legislators within the General Assembly that are seeking to expand abortion. And this isn't just some minor little expansion. If you read the text in the bills, both the Senate Bill 588 and House Bill 563, both presented this past April, when you read the text of it, it becomes really revealing as to what their long-term goals are. And really, it's an expansion of late-term abortions. It's entitled the Whole Woman's Health Act, and some listeners might, if they follow this sort of social policy, they might recognize the name, because it comes from the Supreme Court case, which was Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt, which was a case wherein Texas went to fought against Whole Woman's Health regarding abortionist admitting privileges in the state of Texas. So the North Carolina legislators that crafted this bill decided that they would attach that name, which was the nod to that Texas case, to the North Carolina legislation. However, this legislation doesn't really have much to do with admitting privileges in the state of North Carolina for abortionists. This is really an expansion of late-term abortions past the 20-week mark.
And I mean, just pausing real quick, that right now that's halfway through a pregnancy. So 20 weeks, that's halfway through a pregnancy. And there are people who want to push further.
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
It is unconscionable. It is absolutely egregious. And for them to, but see, this is part of the problem with the whole current women's rights movement is that they have hitched it to this belief that abortion is a fundamental right for women, and women have to be empowered through access to abortion. And I mean, that's priority number one, is actually destroying that false dichotomy that women are in opposition to their children, and that the only children that are worthy of living are the ones that are wanted children, or children that are free of disabilities. You know, we've seen in, I think, was it Sweden? They virtually have eradicated Down syndrome, and they're praising that advancement in science, supposedly, and advancement in health. But really what that means is that they have aborted nearly all the Down syndrome babies in this past generation. So, you know, there are so many moral issues that are underlying this this assertion that abortion rights equal women's rights. And the legislation, this whole Women's Health Act in North Carolina, this is the tip of the iceberg as far as really what is wrong with the whole abortion, pro-abortion movement. And that doesn't even delve into the aspect that I do cover in my article with regard to 20 weeks being the gestational age that doctors can presently confirm that babies feel pain. And so this isn't just removing pregnancy tissue, as Planned Parenthood says on their website when they're describing a DNE abortion, which is the kind of abortion that is performed in the later part of women's pregnancies. This is, and I'm going to warn your listeners, this is very difficult to listen to. It was difficult to write, but this is the reality of what's going on. A DNE abortion, which is what this whole Women's Health Act would have sought to expand, involves dismembering the baby's appendages and midsection and later crushing his or her skull while using a suction device to remove the brain.
Yeah, and I mean, that's taking the arms and legs off of a baby, breaking the baby in half and pulling the baby out, breaking the skull and pulling the baby out. That's what that is.
Yep, that is. But Planned Parenthood refers to that as removing pregnancy tissue.
Well, they don't want the truth about what it is to be out there for everyone to see. I mean, that's obvious, right, from the way everything's been treated. I mean, the whole, they call it a cluster of cells early on in the pregnancy. It's just an unformed cluster of cells or something in that. And they
sterilize it so that there is no emotional bond there. But regardless of whether or not they acknowledge that emotional bond, it is there. There are plenty of studies out there that talk about the connection between mother and baby, even from the very early stages of pregnancy. And that doesn't really change regardless of how the baby was conceived, whether or not the baby is wanted. I mean, those are psychological things that need to be addressed on a societal level. There's no amount of legislation that can make somebody love a child. That has to come from society and a push toward us accepting both mother and baby post-delivery as well. That's something that pro-lifers get disparaged a lot about. We are told oftentimes that we are only pro-life before birth and we don't care about families after birth, which is completely incorrect. I know so many pro-lifers throughout the U.S. and the ones that I see, I mean, they're running adoption clinics. They're the ones that are taking in and fostering and adopting. So, I mean, I throw the flag on that anyways, but just... The most concerning thing I think that our listeners need to take away from this legislation is that this is not about women's rights. This is about expanding and advancing an agenda that lines the pockets of people like Planned Parenthood and other pro-abortion groups and allows legislators and pro-abortion champions to paint themselves as saviors for low-income women, minority women, because that is those are the groups in society that abortion most adversely affects. I mean, abortion adversely affects the child 100% of the time, but these abortions are specifically targeted to those segments of society. And, we don't hear the left talking about that a lot. You know, they claim to be for poor people's rights, minority rights, but yet they're advancing the abortions, the aborting of this next generation of those same that same segment of society.
Right. And I mean, so obviously the number one party that loses out in an abortion is the child. So that's obvious. I mean, there's a life being lost, but, and this is an unpopular thing to talk about, and I think a lot of people don't want to talk about it, but also the father loses out in that. I mean, there is no right for the father at all in this process. And you know, so feminism is about, you know, first wave feminism was about equality, was about equal treatment for women, you know, in that
voting rights, education, yes, rights, things like that. Yeah.
And that's an equal footing. But when you get to like second wave feminism, and that's where you have like the abortion rights, that type of argument, mm-hmm, feminism, the Margaret Sanger, yeah, those, mm-hmm,
they co-opted the original feminist movement.
Right. And so, yeah, you've got, that's not about equality, because there is no equality for the father. The father can't say, don't get an abortion. The father can't say, you can't kill my child. There's no right. The father can't make you get an abortion as well. Mm-hmm. If you are pro-abortion, the father can't say, well, you have to get rid of the baby. The mother has the decision there. Mm-hmm. And up to the point of the father can't and wash his hands of the baby, saying, I want to abort the baby. You don't want to abort the baby. I'm not involved anymore. Like, and I'm not saying what should be happened, should be allowed to, but there's nothing there. There's no right for the fathers there. There's no equality in that.
And that's an important point to make. And you know what? The response from pro-abortion advocates is, my body, my choice. Unfortunately, they fail to recognize
body, it's a baby's
right, there
body.
There is another body inside of that, yeah, body. And so they are two separate entities. So we're not talking about just a cluster of cells or some lung tissue or liver tissue that a woman is trying to get rid of. This is another human being from the point of conception. And so
the science bears that out.
The science totally bears that out. And we would treat any other sort of organism differently than we're treating unborn babies. It's incredible and absolutely unconscionable. I've said that before, but there's very little other ways to describe the severity of what this faulty logic has led to ever since Roe v. Wade. Now, there were abortions prior to Roe v. Wade. I mean, I was in my research, I've been tracing even just the history of abortion in ancient Greece. Aristotle talks about abortion. He was pro-abortion. He was also pro-slavery and pro-infanticide. So, I mean, we can't, even though we got many very great ideas on theories of government from him, there, even from that stage, there was a reckoning that needed to happen with regard to how society treated innocent lives. And I would say there was a huge turn when the Romans took over and Christianity became a prominent form of thought within society in the West, and that advanced the belief in individual rights to include the rights of the unborn. So there's a long history that America needs to deal with regard to the treatment of others, from the way we treated slaves to the way we treat the unborn nowadays, and we need voices out there that are willing to take this on and be fearless and stand up against this sort of legislation. These legislators knew this wasn't going to pass in the Republican-led General Assembly, but the ACLU of North Carolina has vowed that they are going to continue to pursue the Whole Women's Health Act for years to come.
Right, and I mean, just, we talked about it a little before, but jumping back to the science of it, I mean, I have a line, like a litany of pictures of sonogram pictures of my daughter from 8 weeks on. 8 weeks on, I have all these pictures. And then I've got the imaging that shows me her face. And I can take that image, that 4D, they call it a 4D image, and I can put it next to her picture as a baby and go, you can tell and recognize. I mean, and you're we go in at 12 weeks and she's waving to me. Like, she's wiggling her arm at 12 weeks.
Wow.
And I remember that. And I'm here, have her heartbeat saved on my phone still from the first time we went, before we even had this little sonogram of her looking like a peanut. Mm-hmm. We had this heartbeat, right, that I said it, and I took that file and I saved it, and I've got it saved in I don't know how many places because I would never want to lose that. And to say that that's not a person from so early on is just wrong. And anyone who takes any time to look into it or has been through a pregnancy knows that it's a person, knows that it's not a cluster of cells, knows that the science does not back up the rhetoric that has been used for, you know, 50 years since Roe v. Wade.
Well, and if it's not a person, then when does it become a person? And that becomes this fluid area wherein there it is a slippery slope. So if the child is not a person at the point of conception, and we acknowledge a very early stage human being, but a human being nonetheless, but if the child is not a person at that point in time, then what sort of markers do we have to indicate and determine when the child has reached personhood?
Well, some will say when the baby's viable outside of the womb. And you say, okay, using that argument, so 20 weeks is on the line, but let's say 30 weeks. There are babies that are born at 30, 32 weeks, 36 weeks, and are totally viable. Basically, once you hit the third trimester, they're pretty much just gaining weight and then some lung development. But let's say you're at the point the lungs are developed. If that baby was born, that baby would not survive. A 40-week baby born is not able to survive on its own. So if that's your argument, if it's when a baby is able to survive on their own, if it's okay at 39 weeks, it's okay at 41 weeks when the baby's been around for a week. If it's okay at 39 weeks, it's okay at, you know, when the baby's about to be a one-year-old. I mean, if you go and follow that argument, or going back to the, was it Sweden that's eliminated?
I think it's Sweden. I think it is.
It's one of the Netherlands countries. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so they're lauding, you know, this Down syndrome eradication. That's a eugenics program. That's what it is.
Yep.
That's the same type of program that North Carolina is paying out settlements to people for neutering them in the 70s because they were deemed too dumb to have a baby. Yep. Or for other reasons. That's the same program that we went to a war in the late 1930s. World War II over a eugenics program. The Holocaust, it was ultimately a eugenics program. And so now people are bragging about this program. And in the Holocaust, they were going after the people of subpar intelligence as well as other groups, you know, the Jews and that sort of thing. But it was ultimately the goal of making the human race stronger, mm-hmm. making it better, and that's what a eugenics program is, and that's what
social Darwinism does. You know, it is about achieving this superior human race by any means necessary. And like you've noted and drawn the parallels between the history of eugenics and what we're seeing nowadays, you know, and so in the Netherlands, yep, it's Down syndrome that is attempting to be eradicated. Here in the United States, the argument for abortion is if your child is going to be born into poverty or is not wanted. You know, it's still eradicating a group of people based
eradicating
on
hardship for yourself, for one.
Right. And my proposition in the article at the end of it is to ask North Carolinians, what can we do to create a society where the mother and the child feel supported and where we're lifting up families? So we're encouraging marriage. We're encouraging the father to step up. There are some men that want to step up, and they have been denied that chance to father because the woman decided to have an abortion, or sometimes the tables are switched, and there's young ladies that feel pressured into abortions by the fathers or their own parents. But we as a society, there's got to be a change there as well. So, you know, we could have the best policies and best pro-life policies around, but there still has to be a heart change within society. So yesterday I visited Gateway Campus, which I cite in the article, and that is a pregnancy resource center. And they exist to help young mothers and those just found that have found themselves in unplanned pregnancies, and they walk with the mother through these difficulties, because in a society that embraces abortion and pushes that as the best opportunity for you to get ahead in life, it is difficult for, let's say, a 17-year-old girl who finds herself pregnant. It's difficult for her to say no to abortion when everybody else is telling her she should say yes to it. So people like Gateway are there to walk these women through this, and let them know that they are strong enough to do this and that there are support networks for them. But in this article, I also talk about the pain that abortion has caused. There was one girl in particular, her name was Kristen, and she had an abortion back in 2014. And the emotional devastation that she experienced after this abortion it took her 3 years to recover from that. And she said she would just sob and cry and couldn't get the sound of the suction out of her mind. And we don't focus enough on that as well, the pain that abortion leaves on the hearts and minds of these women, and sometimes the bodies. I know a woman personally who ended up sterile after having, I think she had 2 or 3 abortions, and never was able to conceive children after that again. So there are so many things wrong with this legislation, and it is taking for granted information that has been fed to them by the pro-abortion lobby. And North Carolinians need to know the truth about this and ask their legislators, why did you support this? What about this do you feel was helpful to society or protecting of society's most vulnerable?
Right. And I just kind of jumping back to, changing the way we think as a society. So this is something that, my daughter is about to turn 2. So I'm a long ways off of this. But I've quarterback, whatever, thought about this. But it's like a baby's never a bad thing. It's kind of the way I look at it. Like, there are babies that have my accident. There are inconvenient times mm-hmm. to have a baby, when you're young, when you're in college, when you're in high school, God forbid, but there are a baby's still never a bad thing. And if you go into it with that mindset, then you'll always, I think, come out on the other side better. And I think that the mother and the baby will come out on the other side better. So would I, if my daughter was 16 and got pregnant, or 18 and got pregnant, be upset? There would naturally be some sort of mourning for what could have been in the easier path to get where, the potential for my daughter is. But that doesn't make the baby a bad thing. It's not the baby's fault for sure. But if you don't even approach it from a fault standpoint and go, okay, here's where we are, where do we go from here? And I think that's a system where hopefully my daughter or anyone's daughter who goes through this would feel supported and know that it can be done. You can get through this and come out on the other side okay.
Yep. That's such a good, important point, is that instead of turning our perspective to the child's presence as being something that is harmful and absolutely inconvenient, if we just look at the situation, say, yes, this is going to be difficult, I think first off, we can help other young people understand that it is best to wait till marriage to have children. But also those women that do find themselves in this situation, knowing you're stronger than you think, and there are people that will support you in this, and you're not going to be alone in this. And I think that's a fear for young women, though, if they find themselves in a pregnancy that's not planned. Maybe the father left. Maybe they don't even really know the father. Maybe they were raped. There needs to be a community there, which we talked about civil society, I think a few months back, and the importance of community. And this is one area that speaks to that louder than I think anything else, is the high rate of teen pregnancies and unwed childbirths, and the importance of civil society coming around these women and enabling them to be the mothers that they can be, that they should be, but also simultaneously approaching future generations like sex education with the encouragement that they wait till marriage to have children. I heard an acronym. I was talking to someone last week and they use this acronym called DESC. I don't know if you've heard of it, but this is one way to virtually ensure that you do not end up in poverty later on in life. And the D stands for diploma, get a high school diploma. E stands for education. So go ahead and, or employment, I'm sorry, diploma, employment. So have a steady job. S, have a spouse. And then K, have kids. So if you do it in that order, doesn't mean you have to have a spouse and get married and have kids. But if you are going to have kids, have a spouse first. And that, I mean, even if you don't agree with that on the moral grounds of it, which I think there's a case to be made for the moral grounds of doing it that way. But even if you don't agree with that, the studies bear out that that will definitely set you up for a much greater likelihood for success. I think it's like 98% likelihood that you're not going to live in poverty if you follow it in that order.
Right. And that just makes sense. I mean, and that's the model that I followed it, know about this acronym, but you know, I got my high school diploma, I got my college diploma, I got out, I got a job. I didn't propose till I got a job. After that, you know, we had my daughter who's going to celebrate her 2-year-old birthday next month.
Yeah,
so I followed along the plan I didn't know about.
Good job. Same here. Well, and so nowadays though, with identity politics and just like full swing, people would say that that's wrong to you know, put that forth as an ideal. But the statistics, the data bear it out. I mean, I don't know. People say that's maybe narrow-minded to have that sort of order to one's life. But I say, look, if you know that that's going to be the best guarantee for your child's long-term success, then why not support it? I mean, even if you're just looking at it empirically, support it because you know that that's going to help guarantee your child and maybe your grandchildren have a steady, safe, stable home. And there's so much good that can come from that because then, you know, you talk about unwanted children being a burden on society. Well, if you encourage your kids to follow this, there's a greater likelihood that they won't be a quote-unquote burden on society. I don't advocate for that term, but that is the term that the left likes to use sometimes. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, again, thank you for coming on the show and talking with us about your latest article. It's on ncivitas.org. It's part of the Toxic Agenda series that's coming out, and people should go there and read that one, read Brian's on Medicaid reform, and then come back looking for the next ones.
Yep, sounds good, Matt. Thank you.
Thank you. Ray, thanks for coming back on the show.
I'm glad to be here, Matt.
So, are you excited for Christmas coming up?
I am excited. I used to be one of those people who didn't like Christmas because I didn't like my parents spending money on me or getting gifts. And then I think, too, there were some times where you're like, Christmas doesn't quite meet your expectations. So now I'm much more about Christmas, and we can kind of get in that for a myriad of reasons and discuss just the general season of Christmas and what that means today.
Yeah, I'm that way in a lot of ways, and for my birthday as well. I don't like people spending money on me. I tend not to just spend much money on myself. It's a weird thing, but I guess people expect me to kind of hate Christmas because of my birthday's proximity to Christmas. Mm-hmm. But I never have. I mean, I've never disliked Christmas. I tend to like it until it gets to the short rows and you're trying to get everything final preparations together. I don't like that part.
Yeah,
but. So I like the weeks leading up to Christmas. The week before Christmas, I feel like I'm scrambling a little bit to just get over the finish line.
Yeah.
And then Christmas comes and I'm kind of like, whew.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I like that. I mean, I totally understand. I used to be a little bit of a Grinch. I mean, I kind of liked the Grinch before he sold out when you would watch it and say, oh, I mean, he was funnier to me when he was like trying to steal Christmas a little bit rather than when he was, you know, had a change of heart. But now, I mean, you know, I like Christmas a lot more than I used to, and I really get excited about it. And I think that's just from really understanding it more. What is it? What does the incarnation mean of Christ? And really dwelling on that and studying that some in my life has had a profound effect on me.
Oh, yeah. And that really leads us into our topic for today. We're going to talk about the meaning of Christmas. But before we jump on that, I wanted to go to your point about the Grinch. Do you like the animated Grinch or the Jim Carrey version?
I've never seen the Jim Carrey version, but I definitely like the animated Grinch.
You can, in my opinion, you can skip the Jim Carrey version. It's, to me, it is dark and creepy.
Yeah, I'm not really a big Jim Carrey fan to begin with, so I think that was probably a reason why I never saw that version. My favorite character on that actual animated version was a dog. I was just fascinated.
Oh, yes.
I always kind of felt sorry for him that he was attached to the Grinch and, you know, had to do the Grinch's bidding and, you know, basically had to. I always thought, that's just not nice that he has to pull that huge sleigh.
Oh, it's awful.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, I watched it and I felt sorry for the dog. And I liked when the Grinch changed, you know, his tune and everything. And now when I watch it, I go, it is physically impossible for a dog to pull that sled.
Yep.
Up a hill at all,
right.
Much less a mountain. It really, in a straight line, that dog could not pull that shit. That sled, no, even before it was loaded down.
It was probably brilliant with Dr. Seuss's sort of depiction there, and all of that is the feeling sorry for the dog and just that whole nature of the segment.
Oh yeah, he's just awful to the dog, and then he puts the antler on the dog's head, and the dog does that slow drop to the ground, yeah. And you just feel so sorry for the dog. I mean, immediately you're identifying with the dog.
Yep, absolutely.
But anyway, so you're here to talk about the meaning of Christmas, which is a big topic to wrap your arms around. So kind of take us into it.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's just exciting, this whole idea of the incarnation, which is a staple of Christianity. That's the reason we celebrate Christmas. This whole idea of the birth of Christ. Of course, Bethlehem means house of bread. And we have this great quote from some of the church fathers and really within scripture, just this the whole idea of the bread of heaven coming down to feed the hungry on earth. And, you know, to me, just as I started growing up and went to study in school and seminary and studying the whole nature of the incarnation of Christ and what that means, this whole question of why did God become human, I think is really not just in some ways difficult to wrap your mind around, but very just humbling, this whole aspect of God coming as a lowly baby within a manger in a very humble state in that nativity scene in Bethlehem. And why does that happen? Why does God send Christ down to be a human? And it really sort of transforms everything about our created nature, because not only did Jesus, you know, and God become human, but now humanity is taken up into the Godhead as part of the Trinity. To me, that's just so fascinating that there is now a human person within the Trinity, and just the whole, like, wrap your head around that. And I think that's a very comforting topic, you know, if you're a Christian, because there's no way that I believe that God will leave behind humanity when he is, in fact, part human now through the person of Jesus Christ. And so this just the whole idea of our saving nature is not just about the cross. Sometimes Christians think of, you know, we're saved through the cross, and we are. We certainly are. But we're also saved through this vicarious humanity of Christ in terms of just taking upon our whole nature, and it helps us understand who we are more of a person, because through the incarnation, not only does God reveal himself to humanity, but we are revealed, you know, humanity is revealed to itself in many ways, because the way that Christ lives as a truly human person, he relates our true nature to ourselves. And so to me, that whole meaning of Christmas is just so powerful. It's not just about gifts. Of course, it's not just about presents or materialism or trying to pile up more stuff, but really understanding what the meaning of Christmas is and how that can transform and have a profound impact upon our lives.
Right. I mean, that's a deep dive right off the bat down into the topic there, for sure. But in a way that always kind of interests me is that there are people who don't go to church, who don't believe, are not Christians, or they celebrate they ascribe to a different faith. And they will still celebrate Christmas and still follow in that tradition that for them is a totally secular.
Yeah. Tradition. So it's been sort of this kind of like this holiday within civil society, which I understand. You know, it's a cultural thing in America, especially over a large part of just, say, a religious thing. And so, you know, I would just encourage listeners to really focus on the true nature of Christmas. What does it mean? And what does the aspect of giving pertain to? It pertains to sacrificing part of yourself, just as Jesus did, and really focusing on that aspect of Christmas. And sure, there's always going to be a cultural ramification wrapped up in Christmas. And, you know, sometimes we don't even pay attention to the nativity scenes or the symbols around us that lead us to a greater hope. And we're focused, you know, on what can we get or what can we buy or what can we give to our kids. And all that stuff can be important to some degree, but it shouldn't overshadow the real meaning of Christmas and what it truly means. Just getting back to that question, why did God become human? I think focusing on that question at Christmas time is really helpful. I mean, especially if you're a Christian and that's your faith perspective, I think that can be really helpful. And I think there's also an aspect too, I just wrote about this on our blog, is to not always, you know, to take a time to pause, not get caught up in politics so much. I mean, obviously politics is important in some of our cultural things, not getting caught up in all that, taking a moment of pause and reflection in our lives to really think about the deeper meanings, the deeper spiritual significances that can elevate us as a person. I mean, there's this great quote from G.K. Chesterton, who was a Catholic thinker, writer, theologian, who talked about, he talked about how a lot of modern theologians miss the meaning of Christmas, but not just hymn writers, but Christmas carol writers, that they never forgot the meaning of Christmas, that they were always able to elaborate and really reflect on the deep meaning of Christmas. And that's one thing I like about a lot of these Christmas carols, is it teaches us the theology of Christmas and teaches us what Christmas is really about.
Right. I mean, Christmas is one of those holidays that it's there's so many elements to so many different people about what makes Christmas Christmas. Some people, the tree, you know, the tree is the ultimate sign of Christmas. And you can have arguments about how the tree came to be part of Christmas. And just historically, I don't know how much you've dug into that. And then they say the timing of Christmas and how it was based off holidays beforehand, and how people will say Christmas is an amalgamation of a bunch of different things from winter area, winter solstice, all sorts of stuff, or Saturnalia, which is a Roman holiday. But really, where did Saint Nicholas and Santa Claus, how did that come in? And it's just, it is. I mean, it's a cultural thing. And it almost seems sometimes like Christianity's fighting to keep, I mean, you hear the catchphrase, keep Christ in Christmas. Mm. But it really does seem like people who really want to focus on those aspects get swallowed in a lot of times into this big cultural behemoth that is Christmas, that is Black Friday as the start of the Christmas season. And Black Friday has nothing to do with the Christ aspect of Christmas. I mean, even like the Yule log and the history of behind a Yule log, which is a Christmas thing, but it's also something else as well. It's not part of the Christ in Christmas.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, there's so many examples to jump on with that.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of like a pagan amalgamations or intersections between Christmas and not just different holidays, so to speak, but just different traditions that have kind of melded from different countries. And some of them were, overtaken by the culture with some kind of overshadow some of the deeper meanings of Christmas. And I think, I think it's just kind of getting back to that importance of reflecting on what Christmas truly represents and what is it really about. And I think to me is just sort of meditating on who Christ is and how this, at the nativity scene, you have this baby who's come, who's a king, who came not to be served, but to serve. And you have this baby who comes to us. And you have like King Herod, from the Bible story, who's trying to wipe out all these babies. But yet there's kind of like this helpless newborn infant. Herod can't wipe him out, and he's preserved, and he's there to lift up not just the people in Israel, but the whole entirety of the human race. And so thinking about that to me is just very magical. Reading Christmas stories, reading about the incarnation, what that means, how that changes our humanity. Now that Christ is in his ascension, he remains fully human, abdicates for us. And so to me is all that is powerful. And so I do think there's a little bit of mourning in terms of, you know, that there's a lot of materialism or secularism within Christmas that I think can be disheartening. But I think there's one positive. There's not really any positive aspects about secularism, so to speak. But I think the one thing that you could say about it is maybe as a Christian, it focuses you to focus a little bit more on the real meaning of Christmas. I mean, would you agree with that?
I think it you definitely have to address the question. So when I had to make this decision when my daughter was born, you know, last Christmas was her first Christmas. And granted, she wasn't quite a year old. You don't have to make that decision yet, but you kind of address the decision when you have kids, I think. I'm sure you're coming up on this decision, and parents all know what we're talking about, whether or not to include Santa in your family Christmases, whether or not to include that at all.
Yeah, I think that's
the big guy in red, and it's a real question.
I think that's a good question. I think it's a difficult question because I think all of us want to not just make our kids happy or to give them something extra to experience, but I think that's a balancing act. I think one extreme over the other could be potentially harmful because you don't want your kid to be that like sassy kid at schools that tells everybody Santa's not real, right?
Oh yeah, and you don't want to demonize that kid, Santa,
right? Yeah, and I think the intention behind Santa is good, but you know, I think the thing in our family, my kid's only almost 10 months old now, so he doesn't understand the concept of Santa or Christmas, so to speak. But I think kind of what we've talked about briefly a little bit is, you know, we're not going to look at Santa. You might get one thing from Santa, but Santa's not this grab, you know, this wish list that you go to just get a bunch of stuff and material things. You know, we don't focus on Santa as a main thing, but that's kind of a side aspect of potentially the story. The story and the focus is really on Christ. It's really on the nativity scene. What does the nativity scene do? It points us to an even greater hope. I mean, this whole nature of Jesus is coming down, his saving power, his death and resurrection, and all of that aspect too. And so I think it's just kind of have a balancing act, so to speak. I mean, I think, you know, each family obviously should make the decision for themselves. But I mean, for us, it's sort of, you know, Santa's not this main thing or this little genie where you go to get a bunch of free stuff. Santa's just a little bit of an aspect of Christmas that you can introduce, so to speak.
Right. And I'm definitely, I agree that, you know, when you, of course, you have to mix traditions when you have two families. You know, two people get married, they have traditions from their family, your spouse has a tradition from their family. And we had to figure out what role he would play in that. Because when I was a kid, it was one way. My wife was a kid, it was a different way. But we both wanted to include Santa. Mm-hmm. Because I think we both had positive experiences with Santa. There are kids that feel betrayed, I guess, when their parents tell them there's no Santa. Or they find out there's no Santa. And that's just, I didn't have that experience, so I didn't have a problem with it. But then you had take it a step further beyond the, did I feel betrayed to, is this something I think is a positive experience, something I think should be shared?
Yeah.
And on the most part, I'll fall into the, Santa, I mean, because my daughter knows who Santa is now.
Mm.
She says, she sees a picture of Santa or something. She says Santa. She met Santa at a downtown event, the tree lighting. So it's sort of like you kind of have to participate in a way. You can get out of it, but we just found it would be better to participate and enjoy the Santa.
Yeah. I think for me, when I was a little kid, just to get into a quick story, I mean, the full gig on Santa was up a little bit by first or second grade, because I remember going out to church sometimes, like in our family, Santa would come on the night of Christmas Eve. And I remember going to church one time, and then, like, you know, I think it was like a short service, like 45 minutes, and I'm coming back, and like apparently Santa has gone out to all these houses all over the world in just a few minutes. You know, I was like, just kind of through deductive logic, I was like, I don't know about this Santa guy. So, you know, some people are going to come to a realization in different ways than other about, you know, just sort of the mystical nature or the magical nature of Santa, so to speak. But I don't think there's any problem with having Santa in any way, you know, however you decide to introduce them to your kids or whatnot. I don't think that conflicts with the deeper message of Christianity. I think it's more about really just focusing on the deeper message. And one of the things I like so much about Christmas is just that magical time that you do have to reflect, whether it's in church or at home, about the deeper meaning of Christmas and what that truly says in terms of this whole idea of God becoming human and just dwelling on that. What does that mean for my life? What does that mean for who I am as a person? What does all that mean? And so I think, you know, that aspect of it is just is where Christians need to focus most of their aspects on. And it's interesting, too. I mean, I kind of pointed out on the blog a little bit, but, you know, it makes sense why, you know, we see these like debates in culture about nativity scenes or different, you know, Christmas decorative or creech items is that, you know, they can be, I think there's people that do want to take it down because it makes this whole, I think this is an important aspect of Christmas, but it makes this whole claim that there's something above the state, right? I mean, the state doesn't deserve our ultimate allegiance. The state doesn't deserve our loyalty, but something greater does. And that's God. And whether you're Christian or, you know, another religion, whether even if you're Islamic, Jewish, Buddhist or whatever, is that the state is not our ultimate, doesn't deserve our ultimate loyalty. The state's important. The state can do some things. I mean, should do some things to protect our rights, but there's something higher than the state. And I think Christmas to some degree plays into the, us remembering that too, is that we have a higher allegiance than the government or the state.
Yes. And at the risk of jumping back into the putting Santa focus on Santa, I don't think that Santa is stopping at immigration for all the countries he passes through on the way around the world on Christmas Eve.
No.
He's going where he pleases.
Yes.
But yeah, but definitely thanks for coming on, because it's good to get this back in front in a lot of ways, and more than just a tagline of Keep Christ in Christmas. And you know, you have your carolers and you have your, you know, your Christmas Eve services people will go to, but a lot of times those things are kind of thoughtless in a way, right? Or they're viewed as part of the tradition of Christmas.
Yeah, I agree. And you can't take Christ out of Christmas, because if you do, you really just have a false Christmas. So I kind of chuckle a little bit when people say keep Christ in Christmas. Well, Christ is Christmas in the sense and the proper understanding of it, and he always will be, whether we acknowledge it or not. I mean, it doesn't change it, so to speak. So, you know, I think it's more incumbent upon us to do our part than sort of force people within the culture to sort of bow to exactly what we want, right? I mean, it's incumbent upon us to change hearts or to help transform people, sort of, than just sort of make commands or demands about people upon the culture.
Right, and I think you're in the right place about how there is a place for Santa in Christmas. There is a place for some of these traditions that are a secular tradition, because Santa is a secular tradition. There are places for that in Christmas without losing Christ.
I think so too. Just briefly before we close here, I mean, everything, even Santa and all, on some of these things that are, they reflect a higher thing in our life that we long for. I think this whole idea of Advent, right, is this expectation for something great or needing something great in our lives. This whole idea of Advent builds up to this expectation that we expect something greater, and that comes on Christmas Day with the birth of Christ. And that whole narrative of the Christmas story is that we're expecting something great. And I think even like Saint Nick or Santa Claus or whatever you want to call him in his giving is just a reflection of that higher purpose and power that we see in Christ. So it all in the end should point to one thing in that greater meaning of Christmas.
Definitely. Again, thank you for coming on the show, and Merry Christmas to you. I believe this show will be coming out on Christmas Day. So thank you again, Ray.
Thank you.
Well, thank you to Ray, and thank you to Brooke for coming on the show, and Thank you, as always, to you, the listeners. Have a Merry Christmas. We'll catch you next time.